I'm speaking today with the much-loved radical queer white activist, organizer, elder, who goes by the single name Kendall. So you've had an absolutely sprawling life as an organizer, as an artist, as a writer, and threaded throughout all of that has been your work as a photographer. And I know that you have kind of earned the moniker awarded by Alyssa Pagan or Alyssa Pariah of being the people's photographer of Portland or Portland's people's photographer. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at this place?
Oh, I would love to talk about that. I first really discovered photography when I was 10 years old. I was living in New York, in Queens, and the exhibit of The Family of Man was mounted at the Metropolitan. And I could not go because I was a kid and my parents weren't interested, but someone on my block went and brought home a program. And in those days, a program was all photographs of everything that was in the exhibit. So it was photographs of the photographs in the exhibit called The Family of Man. And I loved that booklet. I read it over and over. I studied every picture. I saw the intimacy of the photographs. I think my favorite one in the whole book is of a woman lying across her bed, cleaning her fingernails. And I thought someone had to be in the room with the camera, and she was so relaxed and she trusted them so much that they could make that photograph. It was absolute a moment of recognition for me as a child and as an artist. And that from that moment on, I nagged my parents about how desperately I needed a camera. And they finally gave me one for Christmas the year I was 10. It was a little brownie camera with a flash attachment. And I still remember with excitement the smell of those blue bulbs exploding when you pressed the shutter button. I was suddenly a photojournalist.
Can we talk a little bit about your background coming into that moment, right? Because you grew up extremely poor in Appalachia, you know, marginalized for a variety of reasons. So to have arrived at that moment of identification, can you talk a little bit more about that background?
Oh, absolutely. I was born in 1945 in the tiny town of Hendersonville, North Carolina, in the Appalachian Mountains. My mother was the first person in the family to get education beyond high school. And she was expelled from university for becoming pregnant with me. So it brought great shame on the family. And the family was pretty hard scrabble and had hoped to sort of lift themselves up into the middle class. And the view that they held was that my mother, by doing this horrible thing and producing this illegitimate child, had wrecked the family's opportunities. And so I was born wrong. I knew that something was wrong. I wondered if I smelled funny. People in my white Sunday school class were not allowed to sit next to me. My mother gave me to my grandparents to raise because she was 21 and had to figure out how to make a living since she'd been kicked out of school for being pregnant. My grandfather worked in a hardware store in the black side of town. My grandmother worked as a lunchroom lady in the white side of town. And they made an arrangement that he would take me to work with him in the morning. And at lunchtime, when my grandmother finished her work and came home, he would take me to her on the white side of town. My first thing that I experienced was this apartheid, that there was one world on the one side of the tracks where it was all Black people except for me and my grandfather, and another world on the other side of the tracks where it was all white people. And I was shunned by the white people and accepted by the Black people. And so I loved that Black community and I dreaded having to go with my grandmother to the white side of town. And that was just my introduction to life in the universe. When I was 5 years old, my mother married a guy in the Air Force. And that's how I ended up being in New York City in 1956 for my 10th birthday, 55, sorry. From that early time, I had many questions And I could not understand how the world worked and why it worked the way it did. And I hoped that I could stay in the Black community. And I couldn't understand why I could not, or why I had to go over where I was being shunned and where it seemed very cold and unfriendly. And I think that that yearning for Black community underlies much of my photography. And to skip way, way ahead to Occupy Portland, that is when I began to be active in Portland community as a photographer. And soon after that, in 2015, I met Teresa Rayford and I began documenting the work of Don't Shoot Portland. And in the meantime, I was on the media committee in 2011 for Occupy Portland. And so I began establishing community in Portland and I began the dream of my life, which was to be a photojournalist and to document what people do, particularly what people do for justice and what people do to bring communities together to work in solidarity with each other. I had had experiences of that in community organizing in the 60s and 70s, and later through my own work with people in prison and through my own work as a theater professor. I ended up working for 6 years in Africa, helping people put together theater as a way to solve problems using the idea of Theater of the Oppressed by Augusto Mbawal, and teaching students in Africa how to do that kind of theater with their communities. So community has always been absolutely crucial to me. And I came to Portland in 2008, not knowing a soul. I retired and I moved here. And I chose this city because I could get subsidized housing here. And I, for many reasons, had no money and have always given away money if I did have the money. And so I needed subsidized housing because I had no further income except Social Security and I had no savings. So here I landed, not knowing a soul, not sure how to build community because I had no job, I had no family, I had no connection. And I floundered 2008, 9, 10, and boom, in 2011, Occupy Portland gave me a nexus on which I could build connection and community. And that set me on fire. I was at that time 66 years old, which was a kind of prime of life for me. I still had energy. I could still squat down on the ground without having to push myself back up. I had dreams and hopes and a drive to be in community, to meet people, to talk to. I should add that I'm a deeply introverted person, but with a camera, I can establish connection with people without having to talk very much. My worst nightmare is a kind of cocktail party where I have to make chit-chat conversation. I suck at that, but I can hold a camera, look someone in the eye, ask with my face, is it okay if I make a photograph? And they can say yes or no, and I will make one or not make one according to what they want. Also, after that initial community building time with Occupy Portland, I became active with Sisters of the Road, and I became a photographer for people who were houseless because most people who were houseless had phones and could keep photographs in them. But the phones at that time did not have very good cameras in them. Now they're much better, but in 2011, most people had flip phones. And they could store photographs, but they really couldn't make photographs. So I recorded people's babies being born and people's marriages happening who were living in the street. I also very sadly and respectfully recorded memorials because those happen more often than weddings and babies with people living in the street. And I began to have community with the people who gathered at Sisters of the Road at that time. And then in 2015, when I met Teresa Rayford, I began documenting the work of Occupy Portland for three reasons. Number one, I wanted a photo record of the work that they were doing. Number two, I wanted people who were part of that work to know they were seen, loved, appreciated, and remembered by photographs. And number three, I wanted people who weren't yet involved to see what they were missing and to be drawn by the photographs into working with Don't Shoot Portland. And at the moment, the Black Gallery has an archival display that includes a great many of those early photographs. I photographed them from 2015 until 2020. And when the George Floyd protests happened during the COVID lockdown, I was not able to continue photographing them because I am old and I have asthma and I could not afford to either get COVID or tear gas. I didn't think I would live through either one of those. So I handed over at that point to some younger photographers who are still doing that work. I'd like to say also something about 2020 and what that did, because COVID separated us from our communities starting. And then Ted Wheeler's decision to use tear gas on protesters for 134 days was devastating. I know young women activists who still do not have regular menstrual periods because they had so much tear gas during that time. I know a woman who lost a baby who was pregnant and lost a child because that tear gas was abortifacient. I know people who just have been horribly changed by the violence of the response by the city of Portland to these demonstrations of love and justice and desire for justice. And that ended a great period of community work for justice. It made surveillance such a frightening thing that people no longer liked being photographed. Being photographed meant that you could be identified by the police, identified by the FBI, identified by the Trump people. There was a zine passed around an anarchist circle called Smash That Camera, meaning that whoever came to the protest with the camera, you should destroy their camera because that was how the people in charge were going to arrest you and prosecute you and perhaps kill you. As I'm sure you know, that people were injured, terribly injured, supposedly by non-lethal means during those protests.
We had the American Death Squad killing of Reinhold, was it?
Yes, who I had photographed. I knew Michael Reinhold, and he was executed. He was a victim of an extrajudicial killing. I would say that his entire body was skeletonized by the horrible, horrible response led by Donald Trump because he was in charge of the FBI and the Secret Service at that time. So that kind of response shut down a great many community photographers, including me. And since then, I have been very, very careful when I do document protests, always to ask permission. And most of my photographs since then, I take from the back of people, just in case at some future point, photographs could be used for surveillance and for attack. So that's the change that I saw happen during the George Floyd protests. Our community has been wonderful about fighting back. Our community has been brave and courageous, and there were a great many people out for every single one of those 134 days. I was not one of them because of my age and vulnerabilities, but other people who were just as vulnerable had the courage to be out there, and I admire them so much. And I'm very sad that there are few photographs. Because the danger of making a photograph was very great during that period.
Yeah, and I hear too that the perhaps the wearing of masks as an accepted part of solidarity and movements is critical to keeping them inclusive and enabling you, for example, to come down and be able to participate and feel comfortable.
Yes.
Comfortable might not be the word when you're facing up tear gas, but and heavily armed cops and all the rest of it.
To have the courage, yes. And masks do help, but I also know that surveillance methods focusing on the irises of the eye are still being used. And so masks help, and they make us safer, but they do not make us safe. It's not enough to make us safe. We cannot make ourselves entirely safe. And that's what courage is all about. It's about not about being afraid and not minding the fear going forward. I'm thinking of a quote from the T.H. Lawrence movie in which he holds a match and it burns down to his finger. And this young lieutenant says, "How do you do that?" And he said, "The trick is not minding that it hurts." And I think that that's what courage is. It's not minding that it hurts. And it's knowing that there is some larger scene, scenario that matters more than my individual hurt.
So thank you so much for speaking with me, Kendall. My guest today has been activist, photographer, writer, poet, actor. Have I missed something? And again, some of Kendall's photographs are on exhibit right now at the Black Gallery, which is run by Don't Shoot Portland, and their website can be found at www.theblackgallerypdx.com. Thank you, Kendall.
Thank you, Desiree.
This has been Desiree Helliger for the Old Mill Variety Hour.